From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The image ricocheted around the world beginning last weekend in Cairo. A woman is beaten to the ground by members of the military who proceed to drag, club, and stomp on her even as her abaya is pulled over her head, exposing her blue bra and torso. After a few seconds, she appears to be unconscious, but the beating goes on. Filmed by a professional cameraman, both the footage and the still are reproduced everywhere, making it crystal clear that, at least in this case, the once vaunted military has brutally turned on Egyptian protesters. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton expresses outrage, and on Tuesday, 10,000 people, mostly women, march in Cairo, many carrying photos of the blue bra woman. Isander El Amrani is a journalist in Cairo who's been following the Egyptian media's coverage of the story. Isander, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So I noticed you've been resorting to a pun that dates back to the early days of vaudeville. You call Egypt still the land of denial.
Yeah, it's a golden oldie, and it seems more true than ever these days when you have so much just complete blatant denial of reality by the military rulers of Egypt and by their supporters in the Egyptian media, who will deny what everyone is seeing on video, that the Egyptian army has in the last few weeks moved to crush protests in a way that's so shocking.
It seems as if the control over the press is not as pervasive as it used to be.
No, but you have to remember the outrage was not immediate. First, we had a picture that came out, and then eventually the video. And the video initially came out on YouTube and blogs, and only later made it to the private stations that have a certain popular following among maybe wealthier people in Egypt. But only later did it go to the state TV stations, where you had guests on the political talk shows trying to deny what happened, saying this is not possible, the army does not do this. People alleging in this case that the pictures or the video was photoshopped, was doctored in some way. It really took the protest we had a couple of days ago here with about 10,000 women coming out into the streets bearing that picture for the army itself to acknowledge that this, in fact, happened.
So this story would not have become the touch point that it has become if it hadn't been for digital media that is outside the control of the Egyptian military?
Well, not only social media and the internet, but also traditional media, satellite TV stations and newspapers who looked into the picture, looked into the allegations that it was doctored and found out that it wasn't. And about 3 days ago, you had a very critical newspaper come out with, on its cover, the picture of the woman being beaten, and the headline was "Liars." The fact that they initially denied it, it really made people angry, and it's a sign of the extent to which the armed forces don't seem to realize how much the world has changed.
What does the role of the image of gratuitous violence do to a movement? I remember the infamous murder of Neda on the streets of Iran, and I wonder if, in some ways, a movement begins to coalesce because of the nature of its victims.
Absolutely, and it's very much the case of the Egyptian uprising since last January. You have artists putting up portraits across the city of over 850 people who died between January and February of this year. There's an iconography here of the martyrs, and likewise, seeing people beat up on television, like this woman, brings them together. You may be an Islamist, you may be a socialist, you may be a liberal, but we can all agree that this behavior is unacceptable.
Do you think that the woman in the blue bra is destined to become an icon of this phase of the revolution?
Yes, absolutely. I think that image will remain in people's minds. But we have to remember that Egypt is a country that's about 40% illiterate. Mm-hmm. Only about maybe 20-25% of the population has regular access to the internet. A lot of people solely get their information from state television, state radio, and state newspapers.
And yet the protesters know this. They carry these images on the street. They put them in front of people who may never get near a computer or who may not be able to read.
That's true. A lot of people have been printing out the image of a girl in a blue bra on large cardboard, taking into protest, going around in their neighborhoods and showing people. Also, the activists, the reason they record so much and they make such a use of YouTube and so much time editing things, it's not just because they want to address the 20% of Egyptians that's online. It's because they know that it'll be picked up by the newspapers, by the television stations, and so on. So that ultimately, if a video ends up on Al Jazeera, one of the most watched news channels in the Arab world, it becomes an international event. We saw with the girl in the blue bra, within a couple of days, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, had to react to this. It becomes no longer possible for state TV to ignore it.
And this is a pattern we're likely to see repeated.
Unless you want to be a completely closed state like North Korea is, your media cannot be completely closed. And we're seeing, a rapid transformation of the Egyptian media in a way that I don't think that any Ministry of Information is going to be able to control. And in fact, some political parties and leaders and activists have made calls for the abolition of the Ministry of Information after 60 years of centralized state-controlled media.
Is that a pipe dream?
A year ago, I might have told you that the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak is a pipe dream. I don't think so.
Isander, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Isander El Amrani is a journalist in Cairo and founder of TheArabist.net.
In political coverage, even infinitesimal changes in a candidate's poll numbers make for headline news.
Newt Gingrich is emerging as a solid frontrunner in the Hawkeye state. A brand new Washington Post ABC poll has
Republican frontrunner Newt Gingrich had surged through November, but our new poll out tonight shows that December has not been so kind.
Now we're seeing the rise of Ron Paul. The GOP presidential hopeful is surging in the latest polls. This as the frontrunner.
Of course, as the data crunchers say, garbage in, garbage out. According to Slate's Sasha Eisenberg, some of the assumptions made in media polls of self-described likely voters may skew the results. In a piece this week, Eisenberg describes a study which found that more than half of the people who tell pollsters they won't vote in an upcoming election actually do vote. And since those people don't get counted in media polls, those polls aren't always as informative as you'd like. Eisenberg says the problem lies in the faith media polls place in voters to be honest.
Anybody can pick up on the other end of the line. Somebody who's not registered to vote, somebody who's not 18 years old, somebody who's not a citizen, or somebody who is not likely to actually cast a ballot. So what pollsters do is they have a battery of questions that they call a screen that's designed to filter out those who are probably going to vote from those who won't vote at all. And from that, they're able to show you numbers that are supposed to represent what the electorate will look like on election day. We've always known that people lie to claim that they're more likely to vote, or after elections lie to suggest that they voted when they didn't. The real surprise is people who say the opposite, who tell a lie that theoretically makes them look bad, that they won't vote, but end up doing it.
It's kind of like telling a pollster, oh yeah, I use porn, or I totally leave the water on when I brush my teeth. It seems like volunteering a socially unacceptable answer that isn't even true. Why would you lie against yourself?
One idea is that people know that saying that they won't vote will get the pollster off the other end of the phone. But another theory is that people use it as a way of sort of articulating their embitterment about political institutions or the media. It's a way of saying, you know, I don't want to be part of this.
And the campaigns have a very different methodology than the one employed by the media pollsters. How do they get a better notion of who is actually likely to vote?
They're no longer reliant on people to be honest about what they will do. They're relying on these massive databases that they've built of voters and their political histories to segment out people whose past behavior, notably whether they've regularly voted in the past, makes them look like somebody who's likely to vote in an upcoming election.
In Iowa, you write that the difference between the data generated by this kind of filtering and the data generated by the media pollsters is particularly significant. Why is that?
It all comes down to the fact that in Iowa, the caucuses are run by the parties and not by state officials. So the most valuable piece of information is a list of people who've caucused in the past. And these are maintained by the Democratic and Republican parties who sell them to candidates for often six figures. None of the news organizations actually have this. So campaigns are building their samples out of a reliable list of people who look like voters. while media organizations are calling people randomly. And what I assume we're seeing is that there's far more volatility reflected in the media polls than the ones that the campaigns are seeing internally.
Does that mean that when we see the ebb and flow of Romney fortunes or Gingrich's or Paul's at the moment that it's meaningless?
You know, a media pollster is putting out calls today, and somebody who, let's say, saw John Huntsman on The Tonight Show last night and is momentarily excited by John Huntsman or just got a piece of mail from Newt Gingrich might tell a pollster that they're likely to vote in 2 weeks. That person may not even be a Republican, may not be registered to vote, and may not be that likely to turn out on a Tuesday night in January. And a public pollster has no way of differentiating that person from a likely voter other than what they say on the other end of the line. And so that probably means that somebody like Ron Paul, who provoked a lot of enthusiasm from people who are untraditional caucus goers, looks a lot stronger in the polls that we're seeing from newspapers and television networks than he does in the polls that his opponents are commissioning privately.
The last presidential election showed a flaw in the methodology of the private pollsters, who did not really account for growth in the electorate.
What we saw in Obama's victory in Iowa and around the country during the primaries and the general election was that he was bringing new people into the process, people who hadn't been previously registered. And so that's one place where public polls that call randomly and just ask for a sort of self-reported indicator of enthusiasm will pick up significant changes in the composition of the electorate faster than calling off of voter files.
So the private pollsters have a significantly more accurate methodology, except when they don't.
That's about right.
All right, Sasha, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Sasha Eisenberg is a columnist for Slate and author of the ebook Rick Perry and His Eggheads, a sneak preview from the Victory Lap.
Coming up, information about science, art, and life that authorities think is too hot to handle.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Government Advisory Board, overseen by the National Institutes of Health, asked the journals Science and Nature to redact some of the details of a new study about the bird flu virus. The study was about an easily transmitted form of the virus, a strain created by scientists in the U.S. and the Netherlands. The virus, first detected back in 1997, is not typically spread from person to person, but the public health community is worried that it might mutate to a form that could quickly spread. That's why this research was undertaken and paid for by the U.S. government to learn more about the disease, to know the enemy, to better prepare for a potential pandemic. But there's another worry, and that's the reason the advisory board is requesting a partial media blackout on the details. And that's the possibility that in the wrong hands, the research could be used to cause a pandemic. Bruce Alberts, the editor-in-chief of Science, one of the journals cooperating with that request, says his publication is taking the board's concerns very seriously.
I think the primary worry is terrorist organizations and possibly even rogue scientists in a facility, as we think happened with the anthrax scare.
If the results of this kind of research could yield such calamity, why were scientists engaged in the research to begin with?
The goal was to discover in places where this bird flu virus exists, like Indonesia and China, how easy it would be in nature, not in the lab, to mutate to a form that could cause a severe human pandemic. And the answer was, surprisingly, much easier than anybody thought.
The researchers did not enter into this lightly. There is a specific public health reason for understanding how these viruses can quickly mutate.
The fact is that this bird flu, when it does transmit to humans, is incredibly lethal. More than half the people die. Lucky for us, this virus does not spread in aerosols. That is, you know, somebody sneezes, The virus goes in the air. Many flu viruses survive in air long enough for other people to breathe it in and get the flu. That's why it's such a dangerous disease, and that's why it spreads better than almost any other virus. These experiments explicitly were asking, how difficult is it to create the bird flu virus in a form that will survive in air and therefore presumably be enormously easily spread through humanity?
So it is not beyond the realm of possibility that using published research of this sort would give bad guys the formula they need to create unimaginable mischief.
That's the belief of the National Security Advisory Board for Biosecurity, which has recommended that we only publish the paper without critical details. The advisory board, the NSABB, has been in existence since 2004. It's looked at a number of different situations like this. In every case, it's ruled in the other direction, that open publication would be the best route to protect us in the future, despite the small chances of terrorists or others getting a hold of this information. This is the very first time they've ruled in the other side that, in fact, we should restrict some of the details to those people who have a need to know.
It's not quite censorship. It's voluntary. And you said, okay, we volunteer. What won't you be including in the published article?
We're not to include the recipe of how to make this thing, how exactly to produce it. And we're not to include the exact results, that is, what mutations were needed to change the virus to a form that is thought to be truly dangerous to humans. So those details will be omitted from the publication, assuming that the government convinces us that they have a mechanism to get that same information out to those who really need it to protect us. This is not just anybody. I mean, just because you're a virologist and you want to know it is not enough. The NIH and HHS and others in the government are processing a draft agreement on how this will be done, and that's what we're waiting to see.
I know that it's hard for one person to keep a secret. When you start talking about hundreds of approved scientists and their laboratory employees, is there any chance under the sun that this genetic sequencing and recipe can remain closely held?
I mean, look at atomic weapons. You can't keep any secret, as far as I can see, forever. And our hope is that by that time, we will have designed defenses against this particular virus, both drugs and new kinds of immunizations.
I certainly understand why you are cooperating with the government's request. But are there circumstances under which you would say to the government, sorry, no, we're going to publish, and here's why?
Here's why is if they can't figure a way to get this information to those people in Indonesia, China, and elsewhere who absolutely need this information, the biggest disaster to me would be if we do not publish this information and 6 months from now, a pandemic strain of flu virus originating from bird flu arises in Indonesia, starts spreading, kills huge numbers of Indonesians, and of course will spread around the world. We have to do everything we can to provide the knowledge to those who need to prevent that kind of occurrence. It's only a matter of time, so we have to prepare ourselves.
Well, I'm not going to be intimate with the sneezing chicken until this whole thing blows over.
This raises a whole new question in my mind. Do chickens sneeze?
Bruce, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bruce Alberts is the editor of the journal Science. Last Saturday, a tearful TV news host wore black as she announced the death of North Korea's dear leader, Kim Jong-il, from, quote, physical and mental overwork. The people mourned with her. Why a people so starved and repressed should feel such a profound sense of loss is a mystery to us in the West. Few countries are as watched and yet as little understood as North Korea. B.R. Myers thinks he can explain the people's pain. He's an academic based in South Korea who has studied North Korea's internal and external propaganda and written about what he believes is the North Koreans' worldview. The book is titled The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Myers told us in 2010 that the key to deciphering their behavior is to understand how their government controls the message, starting with the actual pamphlets that message is printed on.
The paper on which North Korean propaganda is produced is very poor quality, rough. You really can't bend it back and forth more than a few times without it crumbling in your hands. And the TV news, for example, does not show sound. I mean, they have a news announcer who's talking over news clips, but you don't actually get any sound from the news clips themselves. And literally every interview is staged. So if they go up to somebody on the street and put a microphone in their face, you can see them reading off from the cue cards. It's almost comical.
So 100% of news and information that every North Korean encounters is manufactured by the government.
That's right. And it's different from the old Soviet Union or even from Mao's China in the sense that you don't have an underground press. I've talked to several refugees, including the small number of refugees that you can consider real dissidents. And even they say there's none of that sort of activity going on.
If you could somehow dictate coverage of North Korea by the Western press, what would you say is job one?
People in the media basically admit to me that they only say the Stalinist country because they get tired of saying North Korea all the time. And this has to stop because by conveying the misperception that North Korea is a Stalinist state or a communist state, the press has encouraged the U.S. State Department's tendency to extrapolate from Cold War history when dealing with North Korea.
You talk about, in your book, two versions of North Korean propaganda, one for domestic consumption and one strictly for the outside world. Let's start with the latter. It's a sort of ideological-sounding mishmash called Juche thought. What is Juche thought?
Well, Juche thought emerged actually as a result of the Cultural Revolution in China. In the mid-1960s, Mao Zedong came to be celebrated not just in China, but actually around the world as a great and original thinker. And the North Koreans, being right next door to China, felt threatened by this. They were worried that their own people might become infected by this Maoist ideology. So they decided to concoct something that they called Juche thought. But in fact, this ideology is nothing but a collection of humanist clichés. For example, man is the master of all things, or all people are born with creativity. It doesn't really have any bearing on North Korean policymaking per se.
But is presented to the world as the means by which you can understand the North Korean state, the North Korean mentality.
Right. And this is why the world has had such a hard time understanding North Korea, because Juche thought is incoherent. It really is just a series of inconsecutive assertions. It's a decoy. It decoys the world away from North Korea's true ideology, which is something very different.
Decoys. So we know that Yasser Arafat, for example, used to say one thing in English to sound temperate and approachable to the West, and then quite something else to his Arabic-speaking audiences. Now, North Korea, when it does speak to the outside world, it's not engaged necessarily in Arafatian soft peddling, right?
It does try to convey the impression to the outside world that North Korea is just a beleaguered, misunderstood, isolated country that desperately wants to become part of the international community, but is blocked by the United States. Whereas they tell their own people that North Korea can basically do whatever it wants around the world, that the rest of the world is afraid of North Korea.
We're speaking of a population that is living in grinding poverty and with zero political freedom. Yet you see not much evidence of pushback against the regime, which suggests that the propaganda that you've described actually strikes a chord with the people. Not that they've been brainwashed, but that it conforms with their worldview.
Right. Well, you know, nationalism or racism, and when you're dealing with a nation state, nationalism really is basically racism, is it hugely appealing to believe that you are part of a uniquely good in-group and that everybody in the out-group is inferior to you. And another advantage of nationalism is that it works just as well in bad economic times as in good ones. When things go well, it's because you're such a great race. And when things go badly, it's because the outside world is out to get you. And I think this explains why this system has survived so much longer than Marxism-Leninism did. Communism basically promised everybody a better life, and when it failed to deliver on that, the game was over.
An interesting aspect of the North Korean government's message to its people is its surprising insistence on telling the truth, or at least a kind of truth. You write that
China, for example, under Mao, or Russia under Stalin, told people that the harvests had been wildly successful, even as people were starving. North Korea doesn't try to hide the fact that it is economically vastly below South Korea, for example.
Well, it didn't hide that fact for a long time. During the 1990s, when the famine was in full swing, the regime did admit to serious economic difficulties. This is starting to change now. I believe it's because the North Korean people are so aware now of South Korea's material superiority, and they're also aware that the South Korean people are perfectly happy living under the Yankee boot heel, as the North Koreans would put it. And I think this is placed the North Korean regime under pressure to promise that material conditions are going to improve drastically in the next 2 or 3 years. And this is a new tone in North Korean propaganda. They really are claiming, in effect, that by the year 2012, which will be the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, North Korea will effectively be just as economically powerful as South Korea.
How very Herbert Hoover. Your prosperity is just around the corner.
Yeah, and it's a very dangerous thing to do, and it worries me because I believe that when this propaganda campaign falls on its face, it's not a question of if, the regime is going to feel, I think, a certain pressure to divert the attention of the masses elsewhere, and this is where I think we see a higher potential for some kind of diversionary war or conflict on the peninsula in the next 3 years. I think we should beware of overestimating people's readiness to abandon this system. It's not going to be as easy as simply dropping leaflets into North Korea and everybody suddenly seeing the truth. I think we need to remember that people are psychologically invested in this system. If you are 50 or 60 years old in North Korea, you don't want to wake up one day and find out that you've spent your life basically working for one man in Pyongyang. You want to believe that you are part of this sacred racial mission to rout the Yankees from the peninsula and to unite the motherland.
Well, you know, it occurs to me that while they may lack food, resources, any kind of hope for the future, at least they have something that a lot of people in the West don't have. Right or wrong, they have a sense of the meaning of life.
Exactly. And that really is the heart of the matter. I mean, social psychologists like Ernest Becker have said that all culture really is an effort to give significance to our lives. And I live in South Korea, where everybody is led to believe that by amassing as much money and consumer goods as possible, they give their lives meaning. And that ideology really excludes about 90% of the people from success, which is why I think in South Korea you have one of the highest suicide rates in the world. And it's kind of ironic that in North Korea, where the standard of living is so much lower, people do seem to feel more of a sense of belonging to the community. And maybe this is one of the reasons why we haven't seen emigration or escape from North Korea in anything like the numbers that you would expect from a ruined economy.
Brian, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
B.R. Myers directs the International Studies Department at Donsa University in South Korea and is author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters.
Last Sunday, the man who was the last president of Czechoslovakia, before it split in two, and then president of the Czech Republic, possibly the last protesting, playwriting, essay-penning, poetizing president of anywhere, died. Václav Havel seemed a reluctant politician, but he was primed for the role, immersed as he was in the theater of the absurd. His taste tended toward the dark and subversive, hence his friendships with Frank Zappa and Lou Reed, but his politics were sunlit and sincere. A good politician, he wrote, should humbly look for the truth of this world without claiming to be its professional owner, and he should alert people to the good qualities in themselves, including a sense of the values and interests that transcend the personal, without taking on an air of superiority and imposing anything on his fellow humans. It was the communist government's insistence on conformity that led Havel to become a founding member of Charter 77, a dangerous assertion of the right to spread ideas and to disagree with the powers that be. It was sparked by the jailing of the Prague rock group Plastic People of the Universe, a band that dared to be indifferent to the government's dictates. In one of his best-known essays, The Power of the Powerless, Havel writes of the grocer who places in his window a sign, delivered like his produce, with the slogan, "Workers of the World Unite." Most likely, he's oblivious to the message, but that doesn't mean it conveys no meaning. The sign means, writes Havel, that I, the greengrocer XY, live here and I know what I must do. I am obedient and therefore I have the right to be left in peace. But, Havel continues, let us now imagine that one day something in our greengrocer snaps and he stops putting up the slogans. He stops voting in elections he knows are a farce. He begins to say what he really thinks at political meetings, and he even finds the strength in himself to express solidarity with those whom his conscience commands him to support. In this revolt, the greengrocer steps out of living within the lie. He discovers once more his suppressed identity and dignity. He gives his freedom concrete significance. His revolt is an attempt to live within the truth. To live within the truth. How do you do that? How do you know? Maybe you have to be an absurdist, idealist rock and roller to believe you can do it. But Václav Havel did it, so you know it can be done. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, offering email marketing tools to promote small businesses during the holiday season. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, working for access to safer financial products for American families, at PewTrusts.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. A couple of weeks ago, Bob spoke with Hunter Moore, the creator of the amateur revenge porn website called isanyoneup.com. We got a ton of emails and comments on our website about it, and the range was quite expansive. Many applauded Bob's handling of the interview. Evan from Boston wrote, quote, if it were me on the other end of that interview, I don't know what would have happened. The question Bob asked about posting Hunter's sister or mother was spot on.
But quite a few expressed their anger with the piece. The word sanctimonious came up a lot. And in an email, Kevin Dole wrote, quote, just what was that? Because I can't tell if it was an advertisement for that website or an attempt to ambush this fellow. And others thought I didn't push far enough. Paul Menard wrote, quote, I can appreciate Mr. Garfield not wanting to use his microphone as a bully pulpit. However, if you're going to open the door, you might as well walk through it.
On last week's story about the National Transportation Safety Board's call for a cell phone ban in cars, Dwayne from California wrote, quote, I am pleased that the NTSB is finally speaking out, but they're years late in taking steps to regulate this conduct. Here's hoping they make up for lost time. Shell Holtz wrote in support of a ban on talking and texting in cars, but not on the use of cell phones altogether. He says, quote, most smartphones come with GPS tools. Does the NTSB really think it's better for people to return to using paper maps than a GPS system that notifies drivers audibly of upcoming turns? Others took issue with the comparison of texting to drunk driving and questioned whether such a ban could be enforced. Jim N. wrote, quote, you can't turn off drunk and put it in your pocket.
As usual, we love to hear what you have to say. Keep your letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org or comment on our website at www.onthemedia.org and tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Okay? Please?
With us in the studio is Jody Abergan, a producer with WNYC's Brian Lehrer Show. He's here to tell us about his adventures in the world of smartphone apps. He has an idea for an app of his own. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Brooke. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jody. Just so our listeners know, there are all sorts of fancy apps out there, but Jody, you're really aiming for the simple app market.
That's right. There are a lot of simple apps, and let me pull out my iPhone and show you. I have an app that's basically a flashlight. I have an app that's the Constitution. I hit a button and I can read the Constitution. This is what I do in my free time. I also have an app that's called iNap at Work, and you open it up, and it creates random office-y type sound effects. so that you can take a nap at work and your coworkers will think that you're actually being productive.
You didn't pay a dollar for that utterly useless app, did you? Because
99 cents, Bob, please. Who knows why people download this stuff, but they do.
And that brings us to why you're here right now.
That's right. In my piece, I go casting about trying to get this idea made.
Okay, let's hear this thing.
Roll tape.
The first person I spoke with for advice was Rekha Murthy. She's with PRX. They're the company that designed the WNYC app, so I figured I'd keep it within the family. And the first thing I learned, most people making apps, the coding is really a small part of the overall process. There are a lot of steps between good idea and Angry Birds.
Finding out what the goals of the organization
in a
are,
database that can be exposed via an API,
finding out how it's stored,
going
is it in
to
a
wireframe,
do graphic design, and
basically mock-ups of what the app
we
would
call
look
that
like.
Kind of the discovery process. The organizations we work with have to do a lot of soul searching and planning as well.
Soul searching?
Yes. Somehow, what started out as just making an app becomes an exercise in soul searching.
So this sounds like way more complicated than, to be honest, what I thought. I can make a Tumblr page. I can post something to YouTube. Why can't I just go ahead and make an app?
Jody, no one's stopping you from making an app. The question is, do you want anyone to use it?
And that's the key. If I want someone to pay good money for my app, it's going to have to be well-designed and stable. I'll need to update it, add features, and then Apple comes along and releases a new operating system like they did a few months ago, and app developers scramble to make sure their product really works with it. All of that requires a good relationship with a good developer, and that's really going to cost me.
Anywhere from $2,000 to $100,000.
That figure, by the way, doesn't include the marketing budget. If I really want my app to stand out, I'll need ads online, a slick video, and ads in other apps. So I don't have tons of cash up front, and I don't have a team of developers and marketers, but there's still got to be a way to break into the app game. I mean, there's got to be an app's rags-to-riches story out there.
I had no money and, you know, no real knowledge of, like, what I was going to do.
Lisa Bettany is a photographer by trade, but a few years ago, she had an idea for an app. That turned into Camera Plus, which is an app that lets you add filters to your iPhone pictures. It does a couple things really well. And Lisa's on board with the idea that a simple app can go a long way.
You know, we all have needs for really simple applications. There's an app called Tipulator that calculates a tip when you're in a restaurant. I mean, each app doesn't need to sort of take on the world.
And now she's super rich.
We've sold $4 million, and we've grossed $4 million in profit.
But as with any rags-to-riches story, you can't forget about the rags part.
I worked for a year and a half on this app before we finished it. And during that year and a half, like, I was pretty destitute. Like, it was rough.
Okay, that's a bit of a bummer. Rekha tells me that I'm going to need a ton of money and a team of marketers. Lisa tells me that I'm probably going to have a year of destitution. My idea is a simple one. I don't know why I can't get it done.
Jody!
Yes, Bob?
We've been sitting here for like 4 minutes and we still have no idea what your idea is. Can you just tell us about your app?
Okay, you guys ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. This is my pitch. You know, I've been told over and over again that all you need in this world is one good idea and all your dreams will come true. But what if you don't have any ideas?
Out with it.
My app gives you ideas for apps.
I see.
Uh-huh. So you pop it open. You shake it up, and it gives you an idea. And if you like that idea, you run with it. You do what it takes to make it happen. You with me?
I'm so with you.
Bob, are you with me? I'll take your silence as tacit approval.
Okay, take it any way you wish.
Do you guys want to hear some of the ideas that are in my ideas for an app?
May we?
You've seen the movie Men in Black, correct?
Yeah, I believe so.
They have that little machine that erases people's memories.
Yes.
Okay, so that's in there. That idea's in there. Let's see. How about an app that translates baby talk? All of a sudden, you know what they're up to. What about an app that tells you if someone else is already working on your idea for an app and that you should stop?
You're like a human Escher drawing. This idea about ideas keeps folding back into itself. But the ideas you cited are also fanciful. Silly.
Unachievable.
Yeah. So your app is a gag?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm holding in front of me a sheet. Brooke can see it. Mm-hmm. Two sheets of all the ideas that would be in this idea.
You have some that are called absurd ideas, some that are called terrible ideas. Ideas that obviously already exist. Here, give me the other sheet. Then you've got something called good but impossible ideas. And then a fairly small section of actually kind of good ideas.
Read some of those.
Okay. An app that would find you a compatible business partner for your online startup. An app that would let you take a picture of a tasty food dish and then email you the recipe.
Oh, like Shazam for food.
That's a good one.
Thank you.
An app that will identify the color of a wall's pane.
I think it's supposed to say paint.
Oh, paint. No, I mean, there's like, if the paint is actually some sort of Benjamin Moore paint, it'll tell you what the color is.
Oh, I see what you mean.
An app that takes a picture of complicated legal documents and translates them into straight talk. These are kind of good ideas.
And then under the absurd ideas, there's ones that like an app that tells you when you hear a wolf howl, how far away that wolf is.
Mm-hmm. That's really useful.
You never know.
How about an app that will identify someone who has entered your radio studio under the influence of illegal mushrooms?
Well, Bob, I am actually taking ideas for the ideas for an app, and you can email me at ideasfortheideasforanappapp@gmail.com.
I'm on that.
Okay, Jody, putting aside the idea of whether your app will fly, what did you learn about the app world?
Well, one thing I learned is that the app world is taking a similar path to that of the internet in general. 10, 15 years ago, anyone could get in the website game. It didn't matter how it looked as long as you had a website. And then the professionals moved in and made it very expensive to have a great website. Well, that's exactly what's happening with the world of app design. What's interesting, though, is that the web has sort of cycled back a bit. Now there's new tools that are making it easier for anyone to make a great-looking professional website, and I think the same thing is going to happen in the app world. I'm starting to see some companies out there trying to make it easy for anyone to make a sophisticated app.
But that doesn't mean you're actually going to get this thing made.
Oh, we'll see about that. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Brooke.
Jody Avergan is a producer here at WNYC. If you want to see more of his ideas for the Ideas for an App, and I don't know why you would, visit our website, onthemedia.org.
If I were a truly creative person following my muse, I wouldn't care what you think, right? That's why creative Hollywood types seem united in their loathing of the test screenings, focus groups, and audience surveys that always precede a big studio release. There was a time before those market predictors were there, forcing crowd-pleasing happy endings onto tragic movies. But as the cost of movie-making soared, so did the risks and the need for research-based reassurance. Enter Joseph Farrell, founder of the National Research Group in 1978. He died last week at the age of 76, and L.A. Times film writer Rebecca Keegan wrote about his impact on Tinseltown. Welcome to On the Media.
Hi.
So test screenings and market research certainly existed before Joseph Farrell.
That's right. I mean, Gone with the Wind in 1939 was seen by a test audience. So this isn't the first time in 1978 that research principles are applied to Hollywood. But what Joe Farrell did that was really kind of revolutionary was he codified it. And he brought the principles that were being used in politics and in other industries to Hollywood.
So how did he do that? Who was he?
He was an attorney. He was also a sculptor. He had gone to Harvard Law School, and he was working for the Harris Poll, which was a political polling agency. He was asked to open their West Coast office, and that's where he began to see a real unmet need in Hollywood for hard data about how films would perform and also about how trailers and posters were working.
Wow. A lawyer, a pollster, and an artist. Was he able to calm the artists in Hollywood down?
When you ask studio executives who work with Joe Farrell in the 80s and 90s, what they would tell you is that he had this sort of special knack for taking this hard data and translating it in a way that artistic personalities could understand.
Let's talk about a movie that features focus groups and test screenings. Robert Altman's The Player. In it, a screenwriter pitches an uncompromising feature with no stars and an ending where the main character is wrongly executed because that's the way life is, he said. Now, after some test screenings, he is cynically transformed.
The audience is going to love it.
You sold it out. I can't believe it. How could you let him sell you out? I mean, what about truth? What about the reality?
What about the way the old ending tested in Canoga Park? Everybody hated it. We reshot it, now everybody loves it. That's reality.
I just wonder whether or not the cynicism that Altman displays in this film reflects the attitude in Hollywood among auteurs towards these market predictors, focus groups, test screenings, and so forth.
Filmmakers from Altman's generation, I mean, he really was from the auteur era in the 1970s when this practice started to become more common, were really kind of disgusted by it. I mean, they thought their movie should reflect their voice and not the voice of some random people in a mall. I think it depends which filmmakers you ask. Some filmmakers I've talked to about focus groups include James Cameron, Judd Apatow, Mike Mitchell, who directed the new Alvin and the Chipmunks movie, and they have all talked about it as a tool that was useful to them. For instance, Judd Apatow uses test screenings very enthusiastically to find out what other people think is funny. Just because he and the writers and actors he works with are laughing, are other people laughing? Bridesmaids, which Judd Apatow produced,
a blockbuster,
the highest grossing movie in Judd Apatow's career. There's a key scene in Bridesmaids where the bridesmaids get a bout of food poisoning in a dress shop.
Oh, that is a truly memorably disgusting scene.
Yeah, it's really raunchy.
You got food poisoning from that restaurant, didn't you?
No, I had the same thing that she had, and I hope you're fine. Oh, okay.
Oh, no.
Why is this happening?
Nothing's happening.
Oh, my God. You know, I don't really care which dress we get. It doesn't matter to me. I just need to get off this white carpet.
No, okay. God. No, not the bathroom.
It Everybody tested through the roof with audiences. There are many scenes and many jokes in that movie that they were debating. This one, because it tested so well, stayed in the movie.
So what did the director of Alvin and the Chipmunks get out of this process?
Well, he talked about the challenge of finding jokes that both an 8-year-old and a 40-year-old would find funny. And through test screening, they were able to see, do these two different groups of people laugh at the same things? When do they? What kind of jokes do you leave in?
So there's a big scene of the chipmunks with food poisoning?
There's not, but there is a pot joke in there, which parents may get on one level and kids will just think is entertaining because they'll see Theodore staggering around and being silly.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of some famous examples of test screenings that utterly transformed a film?
Probably the most famous example, and this is one that Ferrell worked on, is the movie Fatal Attraction. And spoiler alert, folks, but the test audiences did not like the original ending in which Glenn Close's character, she's not punished enough, was what the audiences felt. So the new ending led to her demise in a bit more dramatic way and was more satisfying for audiences.
Test screenings also had an impact on Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, if you ever wondered why did Molly Ringwald not end up with Ducky, and she ended up
with the John Cryer character that everybody thought she should be with?
Yeah, although some people thought he was maybe not really into girls. And in fact, a number of years ago, Molly Ringwald herself said she thought that character might be gay.
You can't do this and respect yourself.
You know, you're talking like that just because I'm going out with Blaine.
Blaine? His name is Blaine? Oh, that's a major appliance. That's not a name.
Because I'm going out with Blaine doesn't mean I can't be friends with you.
Molly Ringwald ends up going with the hot guy instead of the nerdy guy as a direct result of what test screening audiences
And it was a big
wanted.
Hit.
It was a big hit.
Certain niche films aren't intended to have mass market appeal. So when you do a test screening, do you pick people to watch it for whom the movie was intended?
Sometimes test screeners do that. They do select the right demographic, the age, the gender, nationality. There are some movies that are just not appropriate for a focus group process. For instance, there's this new movie out, Shame, which is rated NC-17. It's about sex addiction. It's got some award season buzz. It's just not a movie that a group of people in a room who you know nothing about besides their age and where they live are going to necessarily embrace. It's a hard movie to watch for many people. I think this process is used best when it's on these big, broad movies that are intended to be seen by wide audiences. And for these smaller art house movies that don't need to make that much money, it's probably not as useful.
Your opinion, Joseph Farrell, good for the art of movies or bad?
good for the movie business, not always perhaps good for movies.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Keegan is a film writer for the LA Times and author of The Futurist, The Life and Films of James Cameron.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And Brooke, here, our senior producer, Katya Rogers from England, writes, insert, happy Christmas message. No, no, Kat. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Happy holiday.
Go ahead. Mock me.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.